Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking about bullying. Now, we do know that something between 15 and 25% of students in the United States are bullied with some frequency. And we also know that often adults are not aware of this problem, in part because many children won't report it. We'll talk a little bit this morning about bullying, how we can address it in the home environment and at school. And our guest for the program here is one of the country's leading authorities on this subject, Dorothy Espalash. She's professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois, and we're pleased to have her here with us on the program to talk. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly people are welcome to call. The only thing we ask is that people just try to keep their questions and comments brief so that we can keep our show moving along. But anyone who is listening is certainly welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate that. These numbers, I think, are maybe a little bit old. What are, do you think, are some of the best, most recent numbers you have just for frequency?
Yeah, we're continuing to find the 15 to 17% of elementary school and middle school students are chronically victimized. So this is an ongoing basis. We also find a consistent number between 15 to 17% are actually the perpetrators of the bullying. So that, you know, that comprises about 30% of the population. Perhaps one of the most disturbing statistics is the remaining 50 to 70% are those that are bystanders or encourage participation and kind of egg on the bully and are friends with the bully. So what we see is that those numbers of 15 to 25% or 15 to 17% really do not accurately reflect the fact that we have groups of kids that are engaging in bullying and promoting this in their peer groups.
Mm-hmm. This was something that I think that we really started to get good figures and scholars really started to pay attention to this maybe about 10 years ago or
Well, it was actually a result after the Columbine shootings and after the Secret Service did the investigation to be able to identify the checklist of do you have a school shooter. We wanted to be able to give a checklist to the administrators, to principals and superintendents. And in fact, what that study revealed is the only one commonality among the school shooters were that 75% of them had been targets of bullies. And that's when the federal government became very, very concerned about intervening. When we talk about the numbers, it becomes complicated because what we're seeing in our research and we're seeing consistently across this country is that the dynamic of bullying is changing as we're introducing technology into the lives of our children very young. Now, cyberbullying is the type of bullying perpetration that happens through instant messaging and text messaging and websites. We are not seeing a huge amount of that, but when it happens, it's very, very severe. So on average, we have about 3 to 5% of kids that are saying that they have been victimized through technology. So we're keeping an eye on that to see how that's going to unfold as young kids are pretending to be old enough to be on Facebook, as kids are given cell phones by their parents at a very young age. And so we're trying to gauge how that's going to play out. The biggest concern for many principals and administrators is a lot of the cyberbullying happens outside of school. So they may set a policy that you can't bring your cell phone into the school or you have to kind of turn it in and you get it at the end of the day. However, when they get the cell phone and they're engaging in this type of cyberbullying at night, it spills over to the next school day. Mm-hmm. So it's really a challenge for principals who many of them do not know how to text, couldn't tell you what Facebook is. And so, you know, we're trying to educate at least our administrators in this state to be more savvy about these changing developments.
Yeah. Do you think that there has been a change in the way that that scholars and maybe also, say, school administrators and teachers think about conflict between children and what it's all about?
I mean, I think we've been forced to, as scholars, to reexamine our own assumptions about kind of normal conflict. And there was this notion that kids just should be able to work it out themselves. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, historical perspectives or the way in which we're raising our children, that does not always turn out very well. And in fact, it can escalate to the point where the victimization is quite severe. And from our studies consistently over the last 15 years, chronically victimized children have the highest rates of depression, suicidal ideation, and anxiety. And that's not something that we should just let children take care of. So I think that attitude has changed. Certainly, I still run into parents who feel that it's not my responsibility as a scholar to kind of tell administrators and parents how to raise their children. But I think that there are many children in our schools that don't have the support from their parents, from their community, that we have to take on a more advocate role for them. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, I've spent my last 15 years doing, that to try to make our schools safer.
Well, I suppose you could argue that maybe minor kinds of interpersonal conflict that is a good thing for children to try to learn about how to work that out between themselves. That's one thing. But what we're talking about is something really different, and something where intervention by adults really is not only appropriate, it's extremely important. So you've got to separate those two kinds of conflict.
Right. And I think also on the former that you're speaking to, that I think that we still have to, as adults and community members and parents and teachers, we still have to coach children in those negotiation skills. We're not necessarily born with this, right? I mean, children need to be taught, and they're looking toward us as adults to say, okay, how are you resolving conflicts? So, you know, parents that are out there, that how is it that you interact with your husband or your wife? What kinds of conflict resolution skills are you emulating for your children? I often tell teachers to pay very close attention to how it is that they interact with other teachers. Students are learning in all of these environments. And so I still think there's a responsibility that we have to be lifelong kind of teachers of this conflict management skills in children, that it's just not, they're not necessarily, some kids are going to get it. They have a personality that, and social skills that will lead to them being able to negotiate interpersonal difficulties. Others need more coaching.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dorothy S. Balash. She is professor of educational psychology at University of Illinois, has done a lot of writing and research on bullying, and that is our subject here this morning for this hour. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. People can join us by dialing the number 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Are there, when you look at the victimizers, the kids who are the bullies, one of the things we know is mostly it's boys, and there may be other characteristics. Are there other common characteristics that you would say that you take a look at them that you would see over and over again?
Well, I think, one, I want to correct you that there are also some real mean girls that are physically aggressive, and in some schools, some of the schools that we've been in, the girls are more aggressive than the boys. Mm-hmm. And boys also engage in social aggression and relational aggression, and so the mean girl phenomenon can also be translated into a mean boy phenomenon. Consistently, our data is showing that boys and girls sometimes are equally aggressive, boys being more physically aggressive at certain time points. So that said, we're always paying attention to kind of the gender lens. But on top of that, consistently, children that have anger management problems are prone to bullying perpetration. Children that see, witness violence in their homes will be at risk for perpetration. In a recent study that we just conducted with 1,100 middle school students, the number one predictor of bullying perpetration was sibling aggression. So either being victimized by your sibling or perpetrating violence against a sibling was the number one predictor of bullying perpetration across 6th and 8th graders. So it shows that kind of family violence. Much of my writing shows kind of, we try to predict how it is that kids become bullies, and it's what we call the social ecological model. So it's individual characteristics of anger and impulsivity that place a child at risk. But if that child comes from a home in which emotion regulation is taught and there's no violence, then that may not be expressed. However, a child that goes into a home and witnesses domestic violence, has a brother or sister who is aggressive, then they go into a school in which there's no bullying policy, they hang out with peer groups where it's cool to bully others, then they're at the greatest risk. So it's individual, it's family kind of factors, it's peer group, and it's society. We also know that a small percentage of bullying perpetration is explained by exposure to violence in the media. So all of these come together to what we call a cumulative risk model. It's not going to be one thing that predicts it. It's not just family violence. In fact, many of our children that may be in a violent home, but they go to a safe school where they're respected every day and they have a connection with the teacher, that buffers them from the display of aggression. So it's a very, very complicated predictive model, which means that the prevention programs are also complicated in how we're going to address this and curb bullying. It's not as simply as putting together a school assembly or singing songs with children. In fact, we need to interact with kids in these different contexts of the family and the school and start to identify and pick away at those kind of predictors.
Mm-hmm. Well, that it's interesting because I suppose that some people, one of the questions I might ask is for the bully, he or she, what do they get out of it? And it may be that that's not exactly the right question to ask. I mean, it may be that they are getting something out of it, but it might also be that it's a style of behavior, a way of relating to other people that they have learned, and that that's just kind of it's not a calculation that they get something. That's just the way that they've learned to relate to other people.
I mean, and it's interesting that you say, like, what do they get out of it? Well, for some of them, they get a lot. They get friendships. They get perhaps high social status within a peer group. If they're attracted to the opposite sex, they may get more dates in later middle school and high school. And so, in fact, there's a number of benefits. Not all bullies know exactly what they're doing. Some have what we call a heightened theory of mind, and they know which kids to pick out, and they know which kids to victimize, and they're able to get their entourage or the people around them to support them. Others are just kind of, like you said, going through life. It's worked for them. This is what they do. This is part of what they see at home. Their siblings were aggressive, they're aggressive, and they just do it. There's less kind of thought about it. So the strategies are different. They're different types of bullies.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does, though, again, is go back to this idea, too, that when you talk about bullying, there's this really complicated social network that goes on, and that it's not just about the bully and the victim, that it also has a lot to do with the other children and what and how they participate, whether they egg on the bully or whether they don't, whether they just don't do anything. At least they don't try to intervene on behalf of the victim. They may not cheer the bully, but they're also not stepping in there and saying, hey, cut that out.
Right. And consistently we have found that the bully-victim dyadic relationship is not typical, that in fact there's a victim, that there tends to be a group of bullies that participate in some way and target that victim. And you're right that when we ask kids why they don't intervene, so we've published a few papers on the willingness to intervene. Who are they going to intervene with? Many times they will not, and their reasons for not intervening make complete sense, right? They may be shunned from the group. They know if they don't have friends that they are more likely to be targeted as a victim. And so when you talk to them, they have a decision tree of like, well, I want to be in this group and they're popular and this, you know, this affords me other things if I'm with the popular group. And so they make a decision. Many kids will intervene if it's a really good friend of theirs that's being victimized. Not always, but they do have this different type of decision that they would make. And this is an important point because here we talk about bullying being this group phenomenon, and we have not a single prevention program that targets the group and the peer norms that support bullying. Not a single prevention program that focuses on the one contextual factor that's contributing to bullying, the development of it, and the maintaining it over time.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess I have to ask why. Why, if we indeed know, if there's good reason to know that would help, and to understand, if we have some understanding of that dynamic, well, why not?
Well, I think that this group dynamic really just kind of came out of the literature in the last 5 to 7 years. There was some hint of it early, but consistently, many labs across the country are finding this group phenomenon, and I think we just haven't gotten around to developing a prevention program to change the peer norms. I'm not sure how we're going to do that. I mean, the first step would be to talk to the children about why it is that they go along with this behavior that they know at some level is wrong, and they've been taught that, you know, that they shouldn't do this. And so I'm hoping that in the future we go to, in that direction. Part of the problem is we're endorsing programs that aren't working, and we continue to endorse programs that aren't working. Mm-hmm. And so as 32 states now have mandatory bullying prevention programming, school administrators are trying to scramble and get a prevention program up and going. And so they pick the ones that are endorsed by our federal government but have not yielded any efficacy data whatsoever.
So you can identify particular characteristics that attach to the bully. Are there particular characteristics that attach to the victim? Are there certain kids that, say, you go into a classroom, you look around, you would say, well, I can tell you who chances are who are going to end up being the victims.
Yeah. And for the most part, victims are rejected and they're isolated. So in some ways, they set themselves apart. Any characteristic that makes you different, any characteristic that they can make fun of. Bottom line, if you are overweight and or if you are awkward in some ways, either socially awkward or you dress in a certain way, they will target that. That's easy for them to do. And so we just did a recent study where we looked at the connection between overweight and obesity and victimization. It was a very, very strong connection. If you act different in any way, if you, for boys, if you are not, if you do not behave in kind of typical boy ways, then you may be targeted. So we also do a lot of work in the relationship between homophobic bullying, sexual orientation. And so if you're sexually questioning or if you're acting not like a boy should act, then you are also at risk. So there's a number of different kind of groups that are at risk. And then there's characteristics that if you're just odd in some way or dressed in a certain way or if you're overweight, you're going to be at risk for a target,
yeah,
unfortunately.
I'm really curious about how early the perception of a person's sexual identity is going to get to be an issue. And I guess I would think with a certain age kids that shouldn't really even be something that you're thinking about one way or another. And how young does this business of you know, here's boy job description, this is the way you're supposed to be, how young are kids looking at each other and saying, no, you're not fitting the mold?
Well, we start to see it in late elementary school. And I think for some kids, it may emerge earlier. But we see it definitely solidified by middle school. Okay. So much so that the language around that's very homophobic. We have extremely homophobic schools for the most part. There's some schools that have kind of lesbian and bisexual kind of gay alliance organizations that minimize that homophobic climate, if you will. But for the most part, that part of that conversation of engaging in the banter of you're a fag, you're this, you're that, is solidified and very, very common in middle school. And what we found in some of our recent studies is that bantering really doesn't affect heterosexual boys and girls because they're, you know, it's just a word for them. It's not really salient to them. But kids that are questioning their sexual orientation as early as sixth grade, it's very, very detrimental to be involved in that kind of bantering. Mm-hmm. And so we consistently are seeing this in middle school.
We have a caller, someone to talk with here in Urbana where we are. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Any studies that you are familiar with, ma'am, linking school bullying to later arrest and prison time?
Yeah, some of the data that came out of Norway, we tend to continue to cite some of Dan Olias's work. That's kind of the classic work. He studied the whipping boys. He did show that boys that were involved, and he looked just at boys, involved in bullying perpetration were at great risk for being convicted of a felony by the age of 25, so six times more likely. We are starting to look at that in the United States. Certainly that's what the federal government is concerned about, to the extent to which these bullies then end up to have criminal involvement. We do show high correlations, high associations between school bullying and antisocial behavior. So in a recent study that we conducted with these 1,100 middle school students, a certain percentage, about 30 to 40% of the bullies were also involved in what we call kind of criminal behavior, whether it was shoplifting, truancy, other types of conduct disordered things. So there is an association. Not all bullies are going to then be involved in criminal involvement. What we're trying to understand are what are the characteristics of a child that goes on to be involved in criminal involvement, that drops out of school, versus those kids that really are bullies, and then they transfer this need for control and dominance into dating violent relationships, or they become very, very successful in the workplace, but also continue to display that workplace bullying behavior. So there is a connection there. It's not a one-to-one connection. I think that bullies are so... So I think, it's not there, but there's certainly a small percentage that will go on to be involved in those types of activities.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for this presentation on such an important topic, and maybe have Dorothy talk about the importance of teacher education, because I have two children in elementary school. And it seems to me from the stories both my daughters are bringing home is that, yes, it takes place right under the teacher's nose. The teacher doesn't want it to happen, and yet it continues during recess, in hallways, in the lunchroom, on the playground. And I'll just end with a real short story. When my daughter was 4 years old in daycare, because she liked Spider-Man and she was kind of a tomboy, the boys started harassing her and telling her that only girls can wear Spider-Man T-shirts, and they would pull her pigtails. And I told the daycare teacher, please make them stop. And the daycare teacher said to me, well, she should ask them to stop herself. I said, she's 4 years old. She's not able to do that just yet. And then it continued into elementary school. My daughter, who is still a tomboy, and last year in third grade, one of the other little girls said to her, why are you a boy? You know, and like, you know, this is very hurtful behavior. And I don't know if it's really bullying. It's just plain meanness that just escalates and follows a child throughout their elementary years. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to share that story and maybe have Dorothy talk about the importance of teacher education and preschool teacher education. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
This is one area that we have not done a great job in. We continue in the College of Educations across the country to do very little in the way of classroom management and helping teachers to control disruptive behavior. When we interview teachers that leave the profession, one of the number one reasons for why they leave teaching is because of disruption in the classroom. And so it's very, very important that the teacher education programs and pre-service training programs consider including as much as they can in the curriculum to give teachers skills to manage this, to recognize it. I am so surprised when I give talks to teachers across the nation that just do not have the knowledge base around what is happening in their classrooms. There's some teachers that perceive that this behavior's not happening in their classroom, and that, in fact, they do not have the skills to even intervene. So I think we need to start in the College of Educations to train the teachers, but we also need to recognize that the general attitude that we have, that bullying is kind of part of growing up, many teachers hold that same attitude. And so we need to do a better job of training our teachers. Unfortunately, as scholars, we're promoting programs that are not useful for teachers. I also want to recognize that teachers right now in this country are expected to do a tremendous amount. The accountability that they are held to and the teaching to the test and the standards have really kind of shut down their ability to work on some of these psychosocial issues that are playing out in the classroom. However, what we need to do is convince our federal government that if kids are safer and they feel more engaged with their teacher and their students, that ultimately that's going to affect test scores in the end. And so we fight very hard. I fight very hard to try to get the federal government to pay attention to this, the Senate and Congress to pay attention that if kids are safer and they're engaged with their teachers and they have, a better sense of themselves, and they will score better ultimately, and we'll have higher graduation rates. So I think that's important. Now, the preschool notion, it is your story is very typical. We are seeing increasing rates of bullying, relational aggression, kind of this gender role scripting, if you will, in preschool. There's only a couple of scholars in this country. Laura Hainish at the Arizona State University does some great observational work with preschool play groups and is seeing some of the bullying and relational aggression that we saw, 15 years ago in elementary, we're now seeing in preschool play groups. So preschool teachers need to also, and child care kind of development workers also need to be educated. We have a long way to go because our, you know, our pre-service training programs are already burdened with a lot of curriculum, but certainly we need to pay more attention to the psychosocial development of children and aggression and give teachers the confidence to be able to identify and intervene in very simple teachable moments in their classroom. I spend a lot of time in schools and I see how teachers interact with one another. And I think that if teachers, didn't create their own cliques within the schools and administrators and teachers got along a little bit more peacefully, then we might see a decrease in the amount of aggression that kids display in their school.
We are at our midpoint here, and I have another caller we'll get to in just a moment. I want to introduce our guest, Dorothy Espalache. She is professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois. She is in her academic work and research particularly interested in bullying and youth aggression. That's not the only thing that she's interested in, but that's been for a long time a big focus of her work. And we're talking about bullying, and your questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, someone also in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Thank you. Are you familiar with Joseph Chilton Pierce? He's written a number of books, but most specifically I'm curious if you're familiar with his book, The Biology of Transcendence.
No.
Well, you might want to look into that. He goes into great detail describing neurological development all the way from when we're in utero up through the final myelination of the prefrontal lobes, which happens in our early 20s. And he talks about how our environment and especially our enculturation and the way we're raised in our early development, but this takes place, throughout growing up as well, how those things actually affect our neurological development and can make us more prone towards violence.
I don't doubt that there's a neurological link. Certainly not my area, but I do appreciate the recommendation. I wish I had time to read all this stuff that people recommend. It's like I'm busy writing my stuff or trying to stay up on the bullying stuff. But it sounds fascinating. We've done very little work in the area of neurology and bullying. Certainly there's some in the area of general violence in adults, but it's definitely a challenge. But there has to be a connection, right?
Well, he certainly does a pretty good job of laying out not only violence in terms of bullying, which certainly is an aspect of it, but violence on a much larger scale as well.
Yeah.
But I would highly recommend it, especially to any expectant parents, because in fact, if a mother is feeling threatened and anxious about her situation while she is carrying the child, in fact, there's a lot of research that has shown that that has a major effect on neurological development even then, and puts a lot more development into the hindbrain and sort of shuts down development of the forebrain.
It's fascinating.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to something that you said, I think, in response to another caller about the fact, if I heard this right, that this kind of relational violence, conflict between kids that we're talking about, we have started to see it in younger and younger children.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
We're just starting to make sense of it because it was a surprise to the child development list across the country. I think I would speculate that one possible contribution to this is the emergence of playgroups. This is just one idea that I have. So parents arrange playgroups with very young children, very young age, they start playgroups. Mm-hmm. And there's an introduction of who is going to be invited, Right. And there's a dialogue, perhaps, even with the preschool child about how they're going to invite someone and not invite someone else. And so there we're already training the in-group and the out-group, right? So the social psychologists have talked about the in-group and out-group phenomenon and that emerging at a younger age. And so we're giving them that the discourse, if you will, to start talking about, well, who's going to come to the playgroup today? And I don't want him to come. I want her to come. And then that goes into birthday parties, right? So then birthday parties have to make a decision of who to invite. And for the longest time, we would have children in preschool or in early childhood handing out invitations in this real public display of who's being invited and who's not being invited. So I think that they're, again, this is not my area. I study middle school kids, the young ones, they frighten me a little bit. So you know, we're really not sure. We're just at the beginning of trying to understand this. And really what's unfortunate is we don't have bullying prevention programs for preschool children. You know, for the most part, we try to look at character education and social emotional learning and those types of things to draw from that. So we're just at the beginning of this to try to understand why this is happening and if it continues. And it's sad because once you're a victim, as the caller says, especially in smaller communities, you remain a victim through most of your childhood into adolescence. So if this is emerging and you get scripted as a victim in preschool, then you have even more years of chronic victimization that lies ahead of you. So that concerns me from a mental health perspective, where many victims that are chronically victimized, which we thought was really from middle school through high school, as adults really struggle with mental health issues. What's now going to happen if that victimization onset is earlier?
Mm-hmm. And again, that this is important because we really know that people who are victims, they suffer from more depression. They are maybe more likely to think about suicide. There are real mental health effects. And I don't know if there are also physical things that are more physical that you can see too. But definitely when you're talking about mm-hmm. negative health impacts of bullying on the victim, they're there. It's really clear.
And in addition to that, and some recent research that we're showing is that in addition to depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and other types of health issues that go with being depressed and anxious and stressed out all the time, they're also at great risk for what we call polyvictimization. So if you're victimized through middle school and high school, and then you become involved in a dating relationship that you're victimized, you somehow just attribute that to yourself and you tolerate it. So kids that are victimized by their peers in middle school are at greater risk for being in a dating violent relationship, victimization kind of scenario, and more likely to marry into a relationship and tolerate abuse. So the victimization, it's called polyvictimization. David Finkelhor talks about this. And those that have polyvictimization have extreme, extreme mental health issues. And so what we're trying to do in some of our interventions is get the child in middle school to attribute their victimization to not themselves, but the actual perpetrator. So move them from internal attributions, it's me, I'm ugly, I'm this, I'm that, I'm no good, for them to be able to say, well, it's something with this person, something's happening. So to get them to move from internal to external may actually buffer them from these severe long-term effects.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with somebody else. Someone on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had two things. One is I read a number of years ago, and I don't remember the author. She was trying to conceptualize bullying as different from conflict or conflict management. And the idea relates to, in fact, as you talked about, the gain is in status. It is in relational ties or whatever. It's not like there's some instrumental goal or instrumental issue that generates the disagreement. And so she was trying to draw a distinction between straight conflict or mm-hmm. normal conflict and bullying and how that is different. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that and how that conceptualization then affects the way that we would treat the situation and try to help. The second thing is you mentioned a number of times that there are programs that are not effective, that we are, in fact, supporting programs that are not effective in terms of preventing bullying. I'd like to hear you talk about why you think those programs are not effective, what you think we need to develop effective programs. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Certainly bullying is different from normal conflict, and bullying tends to be ongoing. It tends to be chronic. There's a power differential. Normal conflicts get resolved pretty easily, and usually the parties feel okay about it, and the perpetrator's not going to hunt down the victim, you know, like a bully would. So certainly it is different, and we have ways of measuring that it's different, and there's different outcomes for that. But there's also a sense in bullying that the victim cannot support or take up for himself, and that there's a real fear. When in normal conflict, there's usually something that can be identified that they can work around. So we do see it as very, very distinct. There is an instrumentality to it, whether it's establishing yourself within a peer group as a dominant leader, that functions as something that they work toward. We still have classic bullies that extort. They'll take your lunch money. They will destroy your property. So we still see some of the classic forms of bullying that's displayed in some of our movies. Your second point, I'm glad you asked this point. And I'll use, for example, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, among others, and now our U.S. Senate has endorsed a program out of Norway. It's called the Oleasis Bullying Prevention Program. It was developed in Norway. It was developed after a suicide pact in Norway when the Ministry of Education decided and ordered a nationwide bullying prevention program. This program has found its way into most of our states in this country. There is not a single empirical piece of paper study that shows the efficacy. The efficacy that is quoted on the web that people pull down continues to be a report that was written out of South Carolina, a final report for funding from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. I have pushed these folks to give us data so that we can actually publish a piece with their names to show that this is effective so that we can stop wasting millions and millions of dollars on this program that's not working. Why does it not work? One, it doesn't address a lot of the cultural issues that are very, very important to American schools. Those include the gender lens that's associated with bullying. Bullying often becomes a form of sexual bullying in late middle school and high school. There's no discussion of gender or sexual harassment. There's no discussion of culture, race, ethnicity. There's no consideration that many of our children in school now are English as a second language, their primary language being Spanish, but we're going to deliver a bullying prevention program and try to elicit empathy and understanding in a language that is not their own. And so it's just not culturally sensitive to the changing nature. It's also not sensitive to the fact that many of our schools differ. We have low-resource schools. We have high-resource schools. We still have a school system that's based on property tax. And I can be in a school this afternoon in a certain place where the textbooks are outdated and teachers may not show up. I can be in another school where each teacher has a laptop or each student has a laptop. So how do we modify these prevention programs when we don't have the resources to use them? This is not the only program that we're endorsing. I mean, there's a big market around publishing bullying prevention. It's hot. But we don't have a program that we can say this will work. I believe that the Committee for Children's Program Steps to Respect is a program that has promising results as well, that has some published data on it. So the Committee for Children's Steps to Respect, I hope, will be able to do some large clinical trials and evaluate the efficacy of it over time and ask those real tough questions of what types of resources do a school need, what does a school need to actually be able to implement this and show positive results. I mean, it's a very, very complicated situation. And for the most part, like we do with other things, we want a Band-Aid approach. Administrators want to show parents that they're doing something about this. But what this has led us to 15 years later is programs that are not effective.
Another caller here, line two, Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I don't know whether this has been mentioned, but I know an instance where the school social worker is doing really tremendous work in this area. So I would encourage parents or anyone else who is aware of bullying to contact their school social worker. A lot can be done because the school social worker can see both the bully and the victim regularly and sometimes together with great results. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to comment on that. I do agree. I think that if there's a way for us to have a dialogue with all of the great teachers and social workers that are taking on bullying prevention, and have a discussion of what worked, I think that would be great, because I think I have run into schools where social workers are having positive results. And I say to those social workers, collect some data, go to your school board, show them that you're doing something so that we can then begin to try to replicate that in similar situations. The caller mentioned putting maybe a social worker working with the bully and the victim together. That's actually contraindicated in our work. We feel sometimes this is what they call peer mediation. We feel that, and anybody that's worked with any type of population that's been victimized, to then place that victim in where there's a power differential in a room with their tormentor, and most times it's tormenting, really does not, it's not productive. And so we suggest that that peer mediation not involve the bullying victim, because it's really just a form of re-victimization. Unfortunately, peer mediation is continued to be used in many of our school districts, and we try to get the word out that this is not the best approach.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. The guest, Dorothy Espalache, she's professor of educational psychology at the U of I, and among other things is very interested in bullying and youth aggression. Has done a lot of writing and research and speaking on that very issue. We thought it would be a good thing to be talking about at this point, since kids are going back to school, and school is an important arena for this. And as she has discussed, it's not something that schools really seem to be very well equipped to deal with. So questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about parents and what it is that you think that parents can do, particularly if they're not exactly sure what's going on. And I don't know, an earlier caller talked about the fact, well, a child came home and said, well, look, this is what's happening to me. And I don't know if it's always going to be the case that kids are actually going to be willing to say to their parents, look, this is what's happening to me. And it could be that they're keeping that to themselves, and parents maybe aren't quite, they don't quite know what's going on.
Right. I think the more typical situation is the child not telling the parents. Okay. So I think that was wonderful that the daughter was able to come home and say, Mom, I don't like this. That would be the ultimate goal. We want kids to feel safe to talk to their parents or to reach out to a teacher or reach out to our mentor. Unfortunately, many kids feel ashamed of being victimized. Again, it's that internal attribution that somehow they've done something wrong, something's wrong with them, so they may not speak out. I have, for 15 years, encouraged parents, do not wait for them to come tell you. Ask them what is going on. Do not ask them closed questions. How was school? Fine. Ask them exactly what, you know, what's happening at school. Pay attention to who they're hanging out with. Pay attention to their friendship networks. If you have the opportunity and you can afford to do this, go into the classroom and observe. Get to know what's happening in the classroom and in the school. Not all parents can do this. Parents work and, you know, they're burdened in different ways. But parents need to also connect as much as they can to the teacher and find out what's happening. Now with email and other types of technology, teachers are reaching out to parents and, you know, not just when a child's in trouble, but hopefully to you know, more positive interactions as well. I mean, I think parents need to keep the line of communication open. Parents need to also recognize that their son or daughter may be a bully. I mean, I've yet in my years of doing this had a parent say, my child is the one that is aggressive. My child likes to be the center of attention and sometimes engages in behavior that I'm not too happy about. How do I have a conversation about how to get their needs met within this peer group without humiliating someone else? We quoted the numbers at the top of the hour. I mean, if the parents are listening and you're paying attention to the numbers, you cannot necessarily think that your child is not involved. Your child is involved in some way. If they're a bystander, have them talk about what's happening in school. You know, talk to, I think parents need to have involvement as much as they can with the school. What we know from our studies is where the school has high parental involvement, there's less bullying and there's less aggression. And so how do we improve parental involvement? You know, I speak to many PTA members, but it's the same parents that show up, right? And so how is it that school administrators can work to get their parents in the school more often? Because administrators, I'll tell you, and teachers, you will have a safer school if parents are engaged in the process of educating their own children. So sometimes parents, for whatever reason, kind of just leave it up to the teachers and the administrators, and then things get out of hand. So how is it that parents can be more proactive about what's happening with their child? Really pay attention to different changes in their child. You know, do they notice that their child is withdrawing a little bit more? This is difficult in middle school because early adolescence is just a time where we think that they're going to be moody and they're going to be grumpy and they're going to change. Well, there's a certain part of that that's true, but abrupt changes suggest that probably something is happening at school, and to look into that and to force as much as they can a conversation with these early adolescents. Again, the numbers suggest that some of these children are involved. Mm-hmm. And so to be open, to pay attention, and to keep talking to their children. I mean, it's amazing that we still say those basic types of things. You know, when's the last time you just sat down and had dinner with your children, or you went out and, did things with them and then had conversations? You know, kids don't really respond to like, hey, let's sit down and have a conversation. You know, they're like, yeah, Dad, that's really fun. But they may accidentally have a conversation with you if you're shooting hoops down at the park. Yeah. So we have to be creative. I'm a psychologist, and when I worked in the schools, I had to be creative. I always called it the water fountain moment, right? So the kid would blurt something when I'm going to the water fountain. Well, that was a good moment. I got something out of him, and then I would follow up later with it. But, you know, they're not going to sit down for a 50-minute psychotherapy session with their parents. But so how do you keep that communication open? Yeah. It's very, very key.
Yeah, it seems, and too, as you said, it seems that a real good opportunity for intervening, obviously, you if you have a child who's aggressive, you've got to do something about that. And you also, if you have a child clearly seems to be victimized, you really need to do something about that. But it seems like the big piece here, as you said earlier, is that we shouldn't just think about this as a two-person game. It's not just the mm-hmm. victim and the victimizer. It's the other kids, whether they are the ones who were part of the bully's gang and her, you know, sort of going rah-rah, or the other kids who are just, they know perfectly well what's going on, but they're standing back, you know, for whatever reason, they're standing back. They don't want to get in the way. They don't want to get hurt. They don't want to become a victim. They just don't want to, they don't want to deal with it. You know, you're maybe here, that's where we're missing the opportunity, is with the others mm-hmm. and finding some way so that we can get them not to be enablers. Maybe that's harder. I don't know if we really, do we really know exactly how to do that?
We're starting to. I mean, there's some programs that are starting. They call the bystanders. And those programs work well in some schools sometimes. But in some schools, we have continual code of silence where the kids know what's happening, but they're not going to disclose to the teachers. They're not going to disclose to their parents. And there's a general expectation that you mind your own business in some schools. And so I think that's a real barrier to intervention. But most certainly, we have to change the school climate. We have to change the peer norms that's supporting this type of behavior. And we know that the peers escalate this, whether it's in the school, whether it's at home on a computer at night. And how is it that we can get them to start changing their behavior early on, because we're seeing it early on, and this is a pattern of behavior that continues. And so most certainly we need to change that climate. I also, as much as we do school-wide prevention programs, we still need targeted individual interventions for those that are chronically victimized and those that are extreme bullies. And so as much as we're going to do school-wide programs, we still have to get those victims into the social worker if you're going to curb these long-term detrimental effects that they will have into their adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Right, way back at the beginning, I think one of the things I said, and you corrected me, I said something about how most of the bullies were boys. And you said, well, don't get trapped in that, because there are girls that are physically aggressive, and then there are girls that are maybe one of the differences, the means of, you know, what are the means of inflicting this violence? They may be a little different, but that's not to say that girls don't engage in bullying. Is that something that one is starting to see more, or is it something that it's one of these cases where you're actually starting to pay more attention to it and thinking about it more?
Yeah, we're paying more attention to it, and we're trying to debunk the myth that girls are only catty and that they're only verbally aggressive. Yeah. There's a great book called Girl Fighting by Lynn Brown. It's a phenomenal read, and it just shows the escalation of aggression and fighting among girls across the country in rural parts of America as well as inner city. And so we're just seeing an increasing. We're seeing an increase in girl offending, female offending. So generally there's just a trend. And we also see boys that engage in what we think is kind of girl aggression, social aggression, exclusion, rumor spreading. And so there's just, it's not, you know, it's not a mean girl phenomenon. In fact, we have aggression that transcends gender, and then into high school it becomes sexual harassment, which is a whole nother topic.
Yeah. We're coming down here to about a minute or two. This is, I know I'm stepping into a complicated area here, but I guess I'm interested in whether, if people are exposed to a lot of aggression and violence, not necessarily maybe as victims, but I'm thinking about violence in the media, either reporting on real-world violence or violence that's in entertainment. If people are exposed to a lot of that, do we have reason to believe that that encourages or fosters violent behavior?
And there's a lot of research. So Craig Anderson does a lot of work at Iowa State on this, and his colleagues, and he actually finds that it depends on the individual person, right? So, I mean, you and I can look at the same violent episodes and play the same violent video games, but, you know, my personality and my other types of things are going to contribute whether or not I become aggressive myself. So there's what we call kind of a lot of mediators and moderators. What is important, what we're starting to pay attention to, is that kids are bombarded with media in which humiliation and put down is a very, very common event. So we're starting to look at some content analysis of those shows, the reality shows and the other shows that kids watch, and to what extent they're becoming desensitized to this type of just picking on one another all the time. So there's, you know, different types of research that's emerging in that area. Certainly the violence in the media is not a good thing, but it's not a one-to-one relationship.
Okay. Well, I think that we'll finish up for right now. Our guest, Dorothy Espalachi, is a professor of educational psychology here at University of Illinois. If people are interested in reading on this issue, or do you think there are good sources
for
bullying?
Oh, sure. There's lots of good sources. There's lots of written on bullying. I have a book called Bullying in American Schools that is real cheap on Amazon, I heard. So, Bullying in American Schools, and we're just coming out with a trade book that's going to be practical strategies of bullying prevention. So they certainly can contact me at the university, and I can send them long lists of bibliographies, depending on what they want. So if they want parent books, there's nice books that way, teacher education books. So there's a tremendous amount to read.
Okay, good. Okay. Thanks very much.
Great, thank you. It was good to see you.